Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
On this episode of the Indie Opera Podcast, it's our first birthday. And we discuss Prima Donna by Rufus Wainwright that we saw at BAM. And Noah and Desiree Alejandro get together and talk about Song from the Uproar by Missy Mazzoli and Royce Vavrick that they saw at The Kitchen here in New York City. Happy awesome. Birthday!
Happy birthday!
Now you are one.
1 year old podcast.
Oh,
that means it should be able to do, like, crawl and stuff, right?
Actually, walk, I think.
Yeah,
I
walk? Some... Well, yeah, that's right. I don't know anything about babies.
I have some nephews who are 1 year old right now, and not only are they walking, they're getting all around. They're running around the house. Yeah. So we can walk now. But do you remember our first podcast?
We are able to walk. Yeah, well, I do remember because I remember I had some of my students on it, and that's funny to think about now. Actually, it doesn't really seem like a year ago was that long ago.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, is that a sign I'm getting old and going to die soon, I think?
Well, yeah. but maybe we should play a little bit of that first. What do you think opera is?
Sure.
Do you want to? Let's listen.
Play it.
Let's listen to this. What do you think of when you hear the word opera?
Grand show.
Have you ever seen an opera?
Yes.
And here in the city or somewhere else?
In the city.
What's the first opera you ever saw?
The first opera I ever saw? The first one I remember seeing was Aida. I was a little kid.
And what did you think?
It scared me a little.
Opera? Ooh, heavy lady singing loud. that's kind of it. Sorry.
My name is Abby LaQuisha Jenkins Sindel.
Okay, and you're a student at
Junior Preparatory.
All right, you ready? What do you think of when you hear the word opera?
When I hear the word opera, I think of loud and commercials.
Oh, commercials.
Yeah, because lately they've been using a lot of opera to advertise commercials and stuff like that for, you know, law, lawyers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that commercial, 877 Kosh, no! and Figaro, Figaro.
Yeah. So, do you remember that? That was crazy.
I do, and hearing those again, I wonder if we never really even got down to those kind of crazy questions, did we? We did a lot of kind of almost journalism kind of things, which I'm happy about. Kind of brought a lot of attention to a lot of really great projects going on in New York. That stuff is all stuff we should keep going, but we should keep doing. But we didn't really ever get kind of messy with the philosophical questions. Right? Am I wrong?
You mean like, what is opera?
Yeah. I mean, you and I should talk about, remember, I tried to send you a thing that we should interview Robert Ashley, and you were like, is this even opera?
Well, maybe I was drunk.
So we should do that. Well, no, but we should, like, do that. We should do it. What are the limits of opera? Like, what is the ultimate limit of opera? And then what can be called opera and what can't be called opera? We should do that.
All right, we should try again.
I'll try something else.
Yeah.
Okay.
So is there anything, like, in the past year that you're most, like, proud of?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, there's a couple of things. I think Song of the Uproar, maybe it's just because it's fresh for me. Wow, my voice cracked there. Did you hear that? I was like...
Yeah, you're one.
I'm one... I'm 1 year old. No, I don't know. I thought Song from the Uproar was amazing. It was an amazing work, and we got lucky to get that interview, and I think it was amazing that Royce was able to work with somebody so talented and so different from other composers. And so that's really my favorite of all the things that we've done this year. Just, I feel like, because it's the work that, I don't know, like watching it, I was like, you know, this is the kind of thing that we should have more of.
Okay, so let's talk about Song of the Uproar. You went and you saw it. Tell me about it.
I saw it, and we have a little bit of an interview. Actually, you know, what we should do is maybe we should just listen to, we should listen to a little bit of the interview that I did with Desiree Alejandro, who's a friend of mine and somebody who's not only a singer, but somebody who's interested in the administrative end of opera. So I thought she'd be an interesting person to bring. And she loved it. She went nuts for this work, you know, and it was, we had a really good time. So let's see, this is that interview.
Desiree Alejandro.
Hello.
And Desiree is a, how do we introduce you? A soprano? How did you start? As a soprano?
I did. Yes.
And then still a soprano, but now you have interest, you want
to... Well, I went to grad school, and I, you know, that, my focus when I was in grad school was vocal performance. And I did that at the University of Houston down in Texas, and you know, after grad school, I made the move up to New York City, and since I've been here, I think always, this has always been a part of my life, but especially since I've been up here, I've definitely taken an interest in, like, the more administrative side of opera. I've always been sort of interested in performing as well as what goes on behind the curtains.
So is it like a business interest, or is it like a program?
No, I think it's more, it's just like, that's where you really see like the total creation of the piece of art. Like when you're performing, you get into the role and you really get into the character, but from an administrative side, there's so many more things to worry about. How are we going to produce this thing? How are we going to fill the seats? How are we going to present this? How are we going to put a crew together to do this? How are we going to be organized about it? There's just so much more that goes into the creation of the entire project, and I think that's always been something that sort of interests me.
Great. And did you ever do any, like, stage managing in high school?
I did, yeah. I actually, well, when I was in high school, it was more like, you know, I was in one-act play and in choir and things like that. But after, when I started college, yeah, I definitely got into, like, I worked in the scene shop, and I would, you know, work on costumes. I actually was the costume designer for a show. Okay. When I was there, and I did a lot of stage managing work, and even when I was in grad school, after I was done singing my final role of the year, I still volunteered to stage manage the final production of the season, because I still felt like it was really important for me to gain experience in that, knowing that it was also something that I was ultimately interested in.
Great. So part of the reason why I wanted to have Des on to this podcast is because Saturday night we saw Song from the Uproar, Missy Mazzoli and Royce Vavreck's opera, and it was the final night, and I was really excited. I'm really glad that you came.
I am. I'm very happy that I was able to catch the final production. Also, a little sad, because it was one of those shows that I would have wanted to go back multiple times and take everybody that I know to see it. I was that excited about the production.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I mean, I was too. I felt like it was, you know, the last thing I felt like this about was Grendel, Elliot Rosenthal's Grendel. Mm-hmm. And it was a great opera, and they only had, I think, 3 performances, and I saw the last one, and it's like, who do you recommend this to? Because you saw the last one.
Right.
I mean, you know, thankfully we had it on an earlier podcast. We tried to tell people to go see it, and we interviewed both of them, but man, what an incredible thing it was, huh?
Right.
I mean, it was just, I don't know. I mean, I guess we can talk about all aspects of it, but
sure.
I just thought, it's such a powerful show, and it's so short. And I love short, powerful operas.
Yes.
I love Wozzeck. I love Salome.
Right.
Because you leave, and you don't need more.
Right.
You're almost full.
Right.
And And there's something to be said for that kind of experience in the theater, right? To have that really short shot experience.
It's also been a really long time since I have sat down for a piece of live theater and actually sensed that the ending was coming and not wanting that to happen. Like, you know when you're reading a really good book and you can tell when you're getting to the end and you're like, oh, I know this book is almost over and I'm so sad. I don't want it to end. I don't want this story to end. And that's kind of how I felt sitting in the opera. I was like, you know, I know that the end is coming, and I'm not ready for it to be over yet. I love this so much. I want more.
I felt like that too. And also, I think it was about, it was funny because I didn't realize, I had heard a lot about the opera talking to Missy and talking to Royce beforehand, but I guess the thing that really, the question in my mind was, how are they going to fit all of this, like, woman's life? I mean, it was a short life, but how are they going to fit all of this stuff, all of these events, all of this action into a work that's, what was it, 75 minutes
75
long?
75 minutes long.
So...
Right. I mean, had you heard of the woman before you went to...
No, I had never heard of her before I had met Missy. I looked, you know, Isabel... What's her name?
Isabel Eberhardt.
Isabel Eberhardt.
And I had never heard of her either.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally, I got a message from you that day. Do you want to come see this show?
Yep.
And I said, sure. And so I didn't research it. I didn't know where we were going. I didn't know the theater. I knew nothing about this show stepping into it. But I think that what was really great about it is something that I really appreciated is that in addition to giving us a great synopsis, in addition to the fact that the composer and the director wrote really, really well-written notes in the program, they also gave us the libretto.
I know.
So we had a chance to sort of glance over that. And whether or not you chose to follow along the libretto as the show was going on, you at least had access to it so that you could sort of glance through it and get an idea of what you were in for.
Yeah, and the other thing is that it's just so refreshing to see people who understand that even if the opera is in English,
right,
I want the libretto.
Right.
It's like if I see a dance piece, okay? I mean, of course there are exceptions, and there's especially for things that are much more abstract, but if I see a dance piece, I want to know what it's about. Not because I want to match up what I'm seeing with what it's about, but because dance itself is such a kind of expressive thing that it's very easy to be distracted by, like, so many other things and to forget about the narrative quality of it. It's, I know that's weird to say of opera, but how many times during an aria are you sitting there thinking about the vocalism?
Right.
And that's not wrong, but there's a reason why these are difficult works to produce.
One of the other things that I really liked about it, and one of the reasons I felt like I sat down and there was just so much going on. You had the singer, and the libretto is sort of in this, it's like poetry. It's poetic form. There's not really like a dialogue going on. She's not necessarily like talking to people. It's the protagonist, and then I think there was four chorus members. Maybe.
I don't know.
And they certainly interacted with each other, but they weren't conversing with each other.
Yeah.
And
almost like, you know, I think they were working with the idea of a Greek chorus, somewhat.
Yes.
Because the individual's ideas or experiences were reflected in the group.
Right.
There was a kind of hive mentality going on. Yeah.
And so one of the reasons that I appreciated the libretto being handed to us was because there was so much going on stage. This was an opera that sort of combined everything. You had film, you had this incredible, you know, this stage was set up with screens everywhere, and not all of the film was the same that was going on. You know, maybe you saw something that looked like a memory of someone as a young child, and then maybe you saw something that was more reflective of, you know, the area that she was located in. And then I don't know if you noticed this, but even like on the side of the stage, they had the sand lining the side of the stage.
I wonder what you think of that, because I haven't thought, it impressed upon me at the moment, but I haven't thought about it again until now, when you just said it. What was the sand about?
Well, I mean, I think it's where she ended up. She was wandering the deserts of Algeria in this opera. And I think just the idea of the whole thing being being presented as a memory, I think for me, I just thought that the sand just reflected, was a reflection of her location and where her life ultimately was taken. This woman died in a flash flood in the desert. And so I think that that's what the sand sort of represented to me on the side of the stage. But it wasn't like, it wasn't a huge focal point. Like, it was just lined up on the side of the stage. But what you did notice is that the chorus members, well, actually, not just the chorus members, everybody in the production was barefoot. So they would come in and they would enter and they would walk through this sand. And then when they would walk onto the stage, the sand would sort of trail onto the stage. And, you know, I just thought...
I think you're right on there. I think that, that there's the physicality to sand that is somehow connected to memory.
Yeah.
Because if you think about sand, you know, you can draw something in the sand, which seems like, you know, it's malleable. It's you can't draw something in the cement with your finger unless it's wet, you know, and so with sand. But then like, at the same time, you just need a little bit more motion to totally destroy what you've made.
Right.
So it's a little bit like memory, or at least working memory. Right.
Yeah. And I think that was what I liked about the production as well, is it wasn't here is the story of Isabel's life and this is how it happened in chronological order and these are the people that she met. It was, everything was presented sort of like a foggy, hazy memory, but it still worked. You still felt connected to this character. I was honored to be in her presence. I was honored to learn something about this woman that I had never heard of before, never met. And I just thought, what an incredible life story that I would have never known about, you know, had I not had the opportunity to see a presentation like this.
Yeah, I like what you said. I mean, I have this big pet peeve with movies and with everything, which is, and my mom drives me nuts with this. Although, Mom, you're one of the best podcast listeners, so I gotta say shout out to my mom. She's a good listener of the podcast. But she does this thing, and a lot of people do, where anything they see, they go, is this a true, based on a true story? It just drives me nuts, because I feel like so much is put into any work to make it perform for you. Like, that's why we like these things, operas, because, like, even if it is based on a true story, someone singing in your face with an orchestra, like, the artificial nature of art is so there in your face all the time, in a positive sense. Not that, like, we're being deceived, but that's this idea of, like, the power of making a movie or making an opera or anything.
Right.
That asking if it's based on a true story seems to me, like, really silly. Like, I almost always want to say, even better, it's an opera. Even better than a true story. It's it's a work of art. You know what I mean?
Right.
But, and I felt like that was something that was honored. It, like, just like you said about this, like, we didn't, you know, is she an important person to know? Because, I mean, I think she's a very important person to know. I think it's a very important story to know. But is she somebody like the Queen of England? Is she somebody like...
It's not that she was an important historical figure. More what I got from it is, here is this woman who lived, what, like over 100 years ago.
Right.
And she was human, just like we are today. And she experienced incredible tragedy in her life. She experienced love. She experienced loss. And so that's what I appreciated about getting to know her. I don't know who you are. You lived, you know, a century ago. There's no other reason for our lives to cross paths other than this production right now. But, you know, we're the same, and humans have been the same for years and years and years. As much as we fight with each other, as much as we nitpick with each other, as much as we like to point out our differences, ultimately, we are the same. We experience these emotions for decades and centuries.
Yeah.
And that's why it was so easy to relate to her and to relate to what was happening on stage. I mean, I have not experienced, you know, the tragedy that she did, in that she lost her mother and her father and her brother sort of in quick succession, but I can certainly relate to heartache and to feeling lost and to feeling like I, you know, want to be somebody who is strong enough and independent enough to sort of create my own story and to take control of my life and to then have my life play out how I want it to. And I think that's what she did when she just sort of said, I have nowhere to go. I'm going to go form my own story.
The whole opera is organized into 17 scenes.
Yeah.
Actually, I like the way you speak. So why don't you read? Could you read scene 5?
Sure. So scene 5 is Isabel arriving in Algeria. She's 20 years old, and she says, I have arrived. I'll pick out my own song, a music that will bleed the heart into silence. I have arrived. I'll pick out my own song, line by line, and at last throw back my head and sing.
That's it. I love that. It's just a poem, guys. I know. It's one of those things of like just...
You get it.
Just... When you say just, it's like... But you mean...
Right.
It's only so simple. Yeah, it only takes this much for all of that to be achieved.
Yes.
In one scene. Yeah. Right. Amazing. No, I think you're right. But you know, it's funny what you said about her being very, very human. I think she is... There's a lot of her... in her story that's familiar, and it is very human. But to me, I kept thinking, she's very kind of superhuman. Because think about how actualized this person was.
Right.
Think about how transgressive most of her decisions would be even nowadays, so yes. Much less 100 years ago.
Right,
and,
right.
I don't know. She's kind of both. Yeah. I mean, she's kind of really understandable on, like, a basic familiar level.
And yet, almost like
a saint or something. Not like in the religious sense, but in this kind of weird iconic sense, you know?
Right.
I felt like we were hearing a story almost like, do you know the poet Rimbaud?
No.
Rimbaud is like a poet, French poet, who did all of his great work before he was like 21 mm-hmm. or 22. And I think he died when he was 23.
Mm-hmm.
And he died in Morocco selling arms. And mm-hmm. you know, crazy life, like very similar kind of thing.
Right.
So it's like his whole output is all like... not very much, mm-hmm. but those poems are really, really great. Everybody kind of loves them, and people mm-hmm. keep reading them and bringing them up all the time. So is he a writer? Yeah, he's a writer, but he's also kind of a legend.
Right.
And I felt like she's a legend.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. You know? I would agree with that. Yeah.
And there are, you know, if you listen back, anybody who wants to go back and listen to the podcast, we interviewed Missy and Royce on, she discusses the specific, there's only, I think, 3 books about this woman,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's mm-hmm. not a lot of literature on somebody who's such an interesting, you know, I mean, I think, I don't know how much to make a big deal of the fact that I didn't see it as much. Well, I did see it in the production, but the fact that she dressed and passed as a man, did you get that?
I think it was certainly hinted at in the costume that she wore, only in the sense that she was in pants really though, and sort of had her hair tied back. For the beginning of the piece, but but that's the thing. Nothing was really literal. Like I said, it's a foggy sort of memory. The way that this whole thing, everything from the music to the video that they used to even the staging, the movement that the director had the characters execute on stage. It wasn't like, now it's time to cross to the center of the stage, now right. it's time to turn up stage. There was a lot of repetitive motion in the staging that he had them do, mm-hmm. Which I think was also reflective of, this is not really happening here and now, this is a memory of her life. And that was something that I really thought was interesting, and I haven't seen a lot of in other productions that I go to. So it made the show that much more unique.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like when I look at stuff, I like the extremes of, I like either realism, like really, really staunch realism,
mm-hmm.
or really
sort of abstract.
Yes. I really like that. And I felt like this was really on that end.
Yeah.
You know, like the hand motions mm-hmm. and the body motions in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And at points I was a little bit like, I guess worried, because the traditional hand motions of like bel canto and the golden and all that stuff
mm-hmm.
always really bothered me. People clutching their fists to their chests and stuff. Unless right. it's really like a part of their singing or their right. body while they're singing. It just bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always like, why can't you just... I mean, I feel like it takes a lot of bravery just to stand there and sing.
Mm-hmm.
But this show, I could tell, after a while, I got used to that. Mm-hmm. I could tell why this was happening. You know, some of it almost looked like sign language.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like, just very, it was very stylized.
Yeah, it was yeah. very choreographed, very stylized. It was very much all done with a purpose, certainly. But I enjoyed it just because, like I said, it was something that I haven't seen in a lot of productions, and I thought it was just used really well.
It was a show that hung together like a show, too. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, despite having 17 scenes packed into a very short period of time,
mm-hmm.
and none of those scenes being chronologically linked in a direct A to B kind of way,
mm-hmm.
it still felt like one cohesive thing, like one opera.
Yeah.
And it also, the interesting things, just from a business standpoint, I thought, not an expensive show to do.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, this show excited me to the point where I, like I said, I, you know, lived in Houston for 5 years before I moved up here. And so I got to know the music scene in Houston a little bit. And there are actually a couple of companies that I know would be very interested in putting on a production. Like, this show is so easy to
right.
recreate.
Right. Yeah, totally. Totally. I think it was, and it could be done on many stages. I think the only thing you couldn't do with it is put it in a huge house like
no.
the Met.
No, it's definitely meant
to be. But that's just because it's
meant to be an intimate piece of
yeah,
theater.
Yeah, I agree.
Sure.
I think so. And the music. Let's talk about the music. We
sure.
really haven't, kind of. I think it did, I don't know. Tell me what you heard, because I know kind of what
Well, I mean, it was, it wasn't that heavily orchestrated. I mean, you no. had some strings, you had the piano, you had an electric guitar, which mm-hmm. I really enjoyed. I wish I could remember there was a specific moment. I mean, I liked the electric guitar being utilized throughout the production. Like, I just really liked the sound that it added to the orchestra. There was a specific moment in the show where I was just like, I sort of sat back and I just said, yes, that's exactly what is
yeah.
needed at this moment. You know, used this distorted electric guitar sound all throughout the show. And the other thing that I really liked about the music and that I thought was so interesting, and I don't think, maybe it has been done, but I haven't seen it done,
mm-hmm.
is the idea of using this pre-recorded track
mm-hmm.
with live music.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
to have that going on at the same time. And it worked because it gives it this... When we walked into the theater and sat down, they had this sort of broken vocal line with this crackling
ambient, yeah.
noise
mm-hmm.
sort of going on. And at first I was like, oh, that's what really interesting pre-show music to have
right.
going on. But then as it turns out, it wasn't pre-show music at all.
No,
it was part of the entire production. And that track would come in and out, and it worked together with the orchestra, and it was all part of the composition. And I thought that the music was something that, especially people from a younger generation, would be able to immediately relate to this idea right. of electronic music or...
Yeah, but I was actually surprised at how little it doesn't sound like electro pop or but it sounds very much like the electric guitar is used in such a way where you know it's an electric guitar mm-hmm. and you know that that sound is something that you're more familiar with in like rock music, but
right.
but still it didn't sound out of place at all. It sounded like the way that she wrote for it, it was another orchestral instrument, or maybe not even orchestral, but another accompanying instrument, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that. I really thought the music was really, really strong, you know, and I think it's so rare, and that's the problem with most new operas, is that it's either the music or the libretto. Mm-hmm. One's always better than the other, you know? And that was not the case with the show. I think it's just the things, everything really seemed paired, you know, and...
It was a very harmonious show. This is the kind of theater that sort of breaks down the stereotypes and the preconceived notions that people have about opera, and that's something that I really appreciate. And I think that's also part of the reason that I'm so interested in sort of the other side of the stage curtain, is because I want to show people, and I have this desire to show people that the stereotypes of what they think of opera aren't always necessarily true. I talked to my coworker a lot, and I was telling him about the show, and I was like, the story is so interesting, and this woman is amazing. And his response was, so opera is also about, like, normal things.
Yeah.
He was like, you told me you went to see an opera. I assume there was a castle and a princess.
I know.
And
someone's
on a
horse.
Like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so this is the kind of show that sort of challenges those stereotypes that we're always faced with. And at the beginning of the show, I was a little worried because I felt like the vocal line was sort of staying sort of in a very middle, singable sort of spot. And I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to be left wanting more. I'm gonna leave this thinking like, God, I really wish she could have sang like a gorgeous melodic line. And I didn't have to wait long
before
I actually did get that.
Yeah.
And so I absolutely agree. This was an opera in every sense of the word.
Yeah. And the vocal writing was very beautiful. Abby Fisher did a great job.
Yes. I thought everybody did a great job.
Yeah. And the kitchen is a good place, man.
I really loved that the singers were mic'd.
Me too.
I loved it. Just because
there were parts where they had to be speaking in a way, singing.
There were parts that called for them to manipulate their voice into a style that wouldn't be considered traditional operatic style, but it was still very musical. There was still beautiful melody to it, but it was closer, sort of like jazz harmonies, maybe some straight tone singing in it. She definitely, I mean, there was just everything in this, the classical singing, there was the manipulated voice where they were more crooning into the mics.
Right.
So it just added to this idea that this is a work where I'm going to draw influence from a number of styles.
Yeah, that's great. Put it really well. it was a great thing, and I'm glad you went. I'm glad we saw it.
Yeah.
Everybody, if you like new opera and you see Royce Vavrick's name or Missy Mazzoli's name on anything, go.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's really great. I would like. I mean, it's also, let's just put out there, if people really do want to consider programming, it's a small cast. It's a small orchestra. It's high on technology. This particular performance, I'm not sure it has to be done that way.
You know what, though? I mean, it seems to me like any modern theater would be equipped with the resources to put this on. I mean, all you need is a projector and a good sound system. I could see this thing. I don't know what it costs to put on an opera because I don't have that skill. But I was kind of taking account of it in that way more than I do with other works because I felt like the thing has legs.
Great.
You know? So anyway, yeah.
All right. Song from the Uproar. If they ever do it again, catch it.
Yeah.
So let's go back and talk about some of our favorite indie opera podcasts.
Yeah, do it.
You know, I actually like our Song from the Uproar podcast too, but not because of the interview with Missy, but because of the way you read all, you know, Beethoven, and I just think the banter was very funny, and I really love that. There's, you know, a lot of things I really loved. I loved our Pride Month podcast an awful lot,
it's so hard to pick. I mean, we got Nico Muhly on the podcast.
I know, isn't that crazy?
You know, I used to just drive and listen to his music. He used to just be like somebody on my iPod.
Little gesture about 6 months ago.
So I wanted to ask you about your process, because it's like it's a part of your music in a way that I think is unique. You seem to speak a lot about how easily you can kind of change things or alter things, or you kind of write while you're working and orchestrate while your process is very transparent in a way that that's not true of a lot of other composers.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm an inherently collaborative composer when I'm collaborating. And I think, you know, when I have enough opportunities to do kind of the me show, that for something like an opera, I feel very open to changing things. And, you know, even as recently as 25 minutes ago, you know, I'm very happy to make adjustments that benefit the piece rather than just benefit me. But I'm not sure if that's unusual or if it's just the way that makes most sense for me or what the deal is. 'Cause, you know, again, composers, we don't really work together a lot.
And maybe it's an attitude that just comes from, you know, interpreting older music of composers who aren't around, where somehow the attitude is, you know, we're trying to do this score justice. And, you know, we were talking about this right before we got on here. It seems like that's not how things go all the time, is it?
It's interesting when people are alive. I mean, I think there's a sense of doing not the score justice as much as the idea behind the score justice. Which, you know, which for me, in a lot of cases, is by necessity a collaborative gesture. You know, and I have many, many friends with whom I enjoy the kind of relationship where they can say, I know what you're trying to do, and this is a little bit unidiomatic, and would you mind terribly if I did it like this?
Yeah.
So that's an example of, you know, the score in a sense of the written notes on the page was a little bit hinky. But then with work together, and you do that, you know, you do that with a spirit of kind of openness. So it's not a question of like everything's up for grabs. It's just a question of like, am I properly realizing the idea? And, you know, if it's not being realized, is it a performance issue? Is it a notation issue? Is it all those things are constantly in play.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to put something out there. We haven't talked about this at all on the podcast. I went to, remember when we did Clarence and Anita, the interview with Underworld Productions and Gina Cusco? While I was there, she said, well, you know, what are your future plans for this indie opera podcast? I just dropped the idea of, you know, I've always wanted to do an opera festival and something in New York. And, you know, I've discussed with my cohorts at Vertical Player about maybe starting an indie opera organization, but it didn't even occur to me that it could go that direction. And Gina had been thinking about that as well.
Mm.
And so basically what's happened here in New York, I don't think anyone's talked about this yet, so this might be the first media mention of it, is we've created the New York Opera Alliance. We already have, I believe, 17 opera companies. According to what we've been able to discover, we've made a list of 75 opera companies in the New York City area.
Wow, geez.
Did you know?
75. I had no idea that there were going to be that many.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. And the idea is to get together and you know, co-market, get to know each other, know what productions we're doing, have a joint, like, calendar, and share resources, audition resources, and just to be on each other's side, because we love the art of making opera, and we're the lab where everything's happening in New York City.
Sure.
So there's a group, New York Opera Alliance, and I'll talk more about it in a future podcast, but we're going to have a website, and we've been working with Opera America, and it's just really exciting.
Yeah.
So I wanted to put that out there. And hopefully in a
year.
One
of the things I remember you said when we started the podcast was part of the reason why we're starting is because we don't know. We don't know what's out there. We don't know who's doing this kind of stuff. I mean, we know the people we know, but we don't know the people we don't know. Now I'm sounding like Yogi Berra. But you know what I mean? Like, we, you know, there's stuff out there that's really exciting. I had no idea that there was that much activity.
Yeah, and so this will turn into an opera festival. I don't know when, and I don't know what form it will take, but I'm dead set on it. So
it'll be like Woodstock, man. It'll be like, don't take the brown acid at the opera festival.
Well, I don't know.
Take the blue acid.
Take the blue acid?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe is opera better on acid?
That, I don't know. I've never done that.
Discuss among yourselves.
Yeah. I would think that it couldn't be. I think it might be situationally better, but I don't feel like you could ever say, yeah, that opera is much better on acid. That doesn't sound right.
I'm sure there are operas that's true.
Mm-hmm. But could you imagine watching something like Le Grand Macabre on acid? But I would maybe try to take my eyes out.
I have no idea. I've never, you know, I'm not. Yeah. I've never done acid.
Me neither, really.
Not my thing. How did we get on this horrible tangent?
Oh, because we were talking about Opera Festival and the famous thing from Woodstock, like, don't take the brown acid.
See, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that? That was like a thing at Woodstock, you know.
Okay.
I don't know. There was like a bad batch of acid going around, and people were saying as a kind of slogan, don't take the brown acid, because that was the bad acid.
You're just much cooler than I am. I don't know.
Why? How does that make me cool? Because I know.
You're just informed.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's just. But that could be bull. You know what, Peter? A lot of times the things that I know are total bull. I've learned that about myself.
But it must have come from somewhere.
Yeah, I know. That's why I think it's fascinating. But, you know, sometimes when you look it up, it's like, oh, that
didn't happen. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. Like one time I read that giraffes don't have vocal cords, which I thought was amazing. So I immediately kind of like internalized that as knowledge. And now I realize that I read that on the top of one of those Snapple caps where the thing can either be true or totally made up by them. So I don't know if that's
true. What do you mean? I thought Snapple, that was all fact.
I thought so too, but then someone was like, no, the point is that some of them are false and that's not, they're not all true.
How can that be the point?
I don't know. I immediately thought that's the worst campaign
ever.
Right, because you're just disseminating these things, and people like me who just love things that are interesting, not necessarily things that are true, just run around and go, "Giraffes don't have vocal cords," and we're wrong, and it's a travesty.
Yeah, it's a travesty. Hey, you know what we should talk about?
Prima Donna. Yeah, I know. I knew it. Yes. You know what's funny? I know a lot of people who've seen this.
Who saw Prima Donna?
Yeah, all of the my friend Javier and the people who in his theater company that they kind of affectionately dubbed themselves the Hipsterecans saw it.
Hipsterecans,
and they all felt kind of mixed about it, although they were much more hopeful. And then we saw somebody I went to school with when we were there. That was the fun. It seems like I know more people that saw this production than normally.
Well, it was a big deal, you know.
Yep.
And it's a big deal because Rufus Wainwright's a big name.
Sure.
And, sure. You know, this is not necessarily the greatest opera, but it at least got new people who might not have seen opera to at least go or think about it. I just wish it was a better opera, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you, but I don't know if I can sign on to that. To that idea of like at least it gets people in seats. I appreciate that he wrote this work and that I think that he loves it, and I think he's putting it forth as something that is, you know, like a total like labor of love for him because he loves opera and you know. But at the same time, like I feel exactly like you. I wanted it to be better than it was. I kind of expected it not to be very good, it was kind of exactly what I expected.
But the audience completely went crazy when he came on stage. They applauded.
Well, he's a kind of a hero. He is a hero for a lot of people, you know, for a million reasons. But I think...
Well, I think he's a great musician.
And that's number one. But then underneath that, you know, he's somebody who is like an out gay man who never was in the closet. And he's a guy who kind of overcome substance abuse problems. And he's a guy who... you know, it's like a million reasons why Rufus Wainwright is popular and well known. There's a reason why Rufus Wainwright is Rufus Wainwright, but this work was not. I hate to be, you know.
Well, let's talk about what did not work for me. Oh my gosh!
That's my wicker chair that I do my podcast from. No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
When you move.
Dude, we should start that's a brilliant idea.
What?
The Wicker Chair podcast, where you just do these podcasts from these really horrible wicker chairs and you can't hear anything. Oh, that's genius. Okay, all right. So yeah, another day.
The brown acid, huh?
Yeah. All right,
Well, no, let's talk about what I felt was its greatest fault, and then we'll talk about what we thought was good. The book. Yeah. The book, the story.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, it was basically Sunset Boulevard set in an opera setting, right?
Yeah, I'm glad that I don't really know Sunset Boulevard, but I bet if I did, I would agree with you.
And the characters are just one-dimensional, and the story is just not interesting enough, and the the moment where the aging diva falls for this, or really wants to impress this reporter, and there's some romantic energy there. Oh, I know. Are you sneezing?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I dozed off while you were telling. What story were you? What were you saying?
It's awful. But the worst part was when he came back later. Like she's like, oh, he's coming back later, and you know, we'll see where it goes. He comes back, and he says, oh, I'm sorry, I can't do this tonight. I forgot a date with my girlfriend.
I know, nonsense.
It was just like
it's like. Ugh, I'm gonna rail against things people love. You ever see the movie Closer?
Uh-uh.
It was horrible, and I feel like the person writing it just sat down and they were like, yeah, man, I'm just going to write about how adults are so dirty and skeevy and no one can be faithful and everyone just likes it raw and nasty. And you're like, it's just why? You know, like making turns in a story for no reason just to be like, so dramatic. I mean, that's how people write soap operas. And that's because they have the format of having to continually churn out a story.
Right.
Which makes it somehow kind of way more interesting than these things where it's just like, no, you only have 2 hours or 2.5 hours to tell. It better be like every moment. That's right. The point of these things.
So let's pretend we're talking to Rufus, okay? Rufus. Okay.
Yeah. Well, first, I think we'd spend like a half hour just being like, we think you're amazing. We are not trying to be haters. We really love opera. We understand why you did this. We'd have to qualify. Let's just put a qualifying block in there before we. Yeah.
Rufus, and then, Rufus, yeah. Love you, mean it. Now, you don't need to do all the writing. I mean, opera is a collaborative effort, and very, very few composers through all of history could do both. The structuring of a compelling story, you know, great lyrics and music, and even some of the greatest composers ever, like you said last time, couldn't write a great opera. It's not something that you can just do everything on your first shot.
And furthermore, even some of the people, well, like Wagner, let's just talk about Wagner, who wrote and did incredible things and were incredible artists, wrote things that are not necessarily great operas. And I know that sounds weird to say, but Parsifal is in many ways a horrible opera. It's a beautiful music. It's a great thing. I'm glad it exists. But at the same time, I would not want to be delivered that as something to put on a stage if I ran an opera company. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'd be like, oh, thanks. This huge, turgid, bizarre trip to the like end of sanity. Thank you. Thank you, Wagner. Same thing for many of the Ring Cycle operas. Like, they're great works, but they're great works because they kind of stretch themselves. You know, they're about, I don't know. And I didn't feel like in awe of this work.
Yeah.
Sorry, Rufus.
Well, the other, and then this, the second sort of negative slash also partially positive thing was there was some really wonderful, interesting music in this, okay? There were some really interesting moments. I really liked it when he got crunchier and the sound got more discordant. And the only problem, and it's a problem I've had with a lot of the composers, let's say, at Vox, where there are moments when they just sound so much like some other composer. Like, he, at moments, sounded like Strauss, as you said, or Stravinsky, or it takes me out of the story when it sounds like such a familiar sonority from someone else's work.
Yeah, I'm not, I agree with you, although that doesn't bother me as much as, what bothered me was that, like, I already believed in Rufus Wainwright, the composer. I already believed that he can write music. And that doesn't mean that he can't change what he's doing or go and do different things, but it's like, he already has my ear. So I couldn't but help but feel like that stuff would have, all of the music, because of it was very beautiful, was kind of meaningless and ephemeral because it was attached to this machine that doesn't work, which is that the book. The book doesn't work, you know?
But do you think that he doesn't trust or he doesn't value the stuff that he writes for himself well enough to bring that into the opera house, and that he was trying to prove himself as a different kind of, like, not that he didn't...
If he was trying to prove that he could write for the stage and write music, then he proved all those things, because that music to me was, it absolutely was operatic, it was vocal, it was well written for the singers. And at the same time, I was like, but there's just no beef here because we're doing an opera and we're not just writing beautiful vocal music here, you know?
Right. So Rufus.
That's why his songs, so many of his songs leave you, kind of have barbs, don't they? They kind of leave you with this kind of, wait a minute, you know? I mean, like, think about something as simple as, like, Cigarettes and Chocolate Milk, which is not really a story song. There's still a lot to really kind of think about there.
Cigarettes and chocolate milk, these are just a couple of my cravings. Everything, it seems, I like's a little bit stronger, a little bit thicker, a little bit harmful.
And there's just, I mean, have you thought about Prima Donna or the kind of conditions of that story at all since we saw it?
No. Mm. Once you leave the theater, you've left the theater.
Yeah. You're like, I really don't want to hear anything about this woman.
Well, you know, all that he needed to do really was call us.
Because we know everything? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing was, and I didn't even know why, I don't know why I didn't bring this up until now, but have you ever, do you know Arabella at all?
No.
It's one of Strauss's operas that has just like the most beautiful music. I mean, it's just, it's overflowing, gorgeous music. And when you sit down and watch the opera and you watch it from beginning to ending, I just don't think you can, you can't help but be like, this is so stupid. Yeah. I mean, it's just about a woman. Who's she going to marry? Who's she going to marry? Who's she going to marry? Like you're playing Barbies. Who's she going to marry? Right. And then at the end, she appears at the top of like a staircase with a glass of water, which is not significant to anyone unless you're a Viennese aristocrat, in which case you understand it to mean that she's going to marry the person at the bottom of the staircase, right? That's what you do when you want to marry someone.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It's so stupid. And then she's just like, ein Glas Wasser. And it's the stupidest moment. I can't imagine that Strauss was like, this is going to be amazing. It's so stupid.
They're going to love this.
Oh, my God. Ein Glas Wasser. They're going to be saying it to me in the streets. You know, like, oh, it's so stupid, and I just thought, it's so much like Arabella. Yeah. I mean, it's just you couldn't have woven a better useless opera. That's what I feel like saying to him. You know, it's just like a beautiful useless thing.
Okay, I think we've ripped on him enough.
Hey, man, we have to be critical, right?
Because no, it's good. It's good. I mean, yeah. I don't want to ruin the opportunity to become his best friend.
Yeah. No, I know. I mean, I know. I mean, he could be the kind of person, but I'm hoping that because he's such a complicated and incredible artist that he would, if he were to actually bother to hear this, would understand that we come from a place of really loving opera, and I wanted that work to be really interesting, and it wasn't, you know. I mean, I wanted him to.
I know he's going to listen.
And he'll do another one, and maybe it'll be great. Yeah. Maybe he'll do Zalame 2.
He's Revenge. Listening right now. I'm sure he is.
Is he? You think so?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Rufus.
All right. Let's put that baby to bed.
Put that baby to bed.
So let's do a few little, like, put some things out that are happening now that...
Yes.
I have discovered, because I've been doing our calendar, mm-hmm. our Indie Opera calendar, there is so much going on, and about every day I find a new opera being produced for the very first time somewhere. I mean, it's every single day I find another one.
Cool.
So that means there are hundreds of new operas being produced every year. And some of them may only be one acts and or whatever, but there is tons and tons of new things happening, as well as premieres of works that have never been performed in the United States. And one of those is Rimsky-Korsakov's, I don't know how to say it in Russian, but it's something like Snegurochka.
Snegurochka.
You know it.
No.
Oh.
No, I don't. I'm sorry. He wrote a lot of wrote many operas that I don't know about, really.
It's The Snow Maiden, and it's being done up in Harvard, and it's we'll have the information on our website, but that's starting on March 21st, which means it already started. But it's running through March 31st, and that's, you know, I never even heard of that.
The whole world of Russian opera, you know, they're just masterpieces we don't know about.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know. There's just, I was just actually listening to, I'm going to mispronounce this too, so we should get a Russian listener to fix me, but I was just listening to Kovanshkina.
I listened a little on the weekend. What do you think?
Oh, I just think it's like the incredible music. I mean, it's just amazing. It's like the Russian Meistersinger. It's amazing. Yeah. But I mean, again, it's a really, really weird, difficult political story. It's just like a three-way civil war.
Yeah.
You know, very difficult for us. I mean, I don't know if it will always be difficult for people to understand that. It's hard for me. You have to kind of sit down and be like, who are the old believers? Okay, who are the, you know, that's tough. I mean, but it's still, what did you think?
I only listened for about 10 minutes while I was driving to the store. I heard it on the radio. I just sort of came upon it. I was like, what am I listening to?
Yeah.
It was great. But then I had to go outside and garden.
It's pretty good stuff for a really drunk guy, you know. Yeah.
So you know, we mentioned Miss Fortune, which is being done at the Covent Garden with that Noah Stewart is in.
Yes, cool.
Well, they've had these performances, and the Guardian, and actually, I've been reading the Independent and all these different British newspapers who completely trash it.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. I mean,
for what? Like, how? Like, the
production? You know, it's actually kind of interesting. They used breakdancers and trampoline, and it's really over the top. And I think their main concern was that it's so over the top for a very simple story. It didn't need it to be quite that way. And they just said a lot of the characters.
Well, except that people did that for, like, many, many, many years, and many, many operas are about being over the top in one way or another and having a simple story. But except for that.
Well, The Guardian said, well, this is the third bad opera Covent Garden has done in a while, a new opera they've done, and they should just cut it up. But what's interesting, The Guardian article mentioned two people, and one of the people they mentioned was Noah Stewart. They said, sang beautifully, and said, they said that he was also beefcake.
A beefcake. Yeah, he's kind of a beefcake.
Cool. I love that.
Yeah, I like that too. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to...
I mean, it couldn't happen to a better guy. I mean, Noah's just the sweetest guy. And then on top of that, to have this really interesting, like, career going on.
Yeah, I mean, he's an incredible opera singer.
Also coming up next week, the Center for Contemporary Opera presents New Opera Week, operas which are in progress. Some of the operas they'll be performing are The Mark of Cain, The Human Zoo, ADA, or ADA, I'm not quite sure how to say that, Big Jim and the Small Time Investors, all being done at the Flea Theater here in New York, the 27th through the 29th. And also, they have an event called Cage Satie and a Cheap Imitation, which will be two nights at the Flea Theater, Friday, Saturday as well. Also coming up on March 31st, Underworld Productions is doing a concert called Cross Current, which will feature music of composer-in-residence Justine F. Chen.
And then further down the road, we want to mention Gotham's doing Il Sogno di Scipione, which is one of Mozart's early operas, right?
Right. I think he was like 14 maybe or something. I don't know. Yeah.
So they're celebrating their 10th anniversary by doing this production, which was one of their first productions. So
okay,
these are
cool.
Things coming up. You know, Ballad of Baby Doe we mentioned being done in Boise. Yeah, I know.
Don't go to Boise to go. Don't go to Boise to see the Ballad of Baby Doe.
But if you're already in Boise,
if you're in Boise, then seeing Ballad of Baby Doe is probably the most interesting thing you can do with your night. I don't know. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe Boise is an awesome place. I don't know. I've never been to Boise.
I would like to say, gosh, we're going to get horrible mail about that, but no one listens. So.
Good. That's what we need. We need to start doing a Glenn Beck style thing. I was thinking about getting glasses, but then I realized we'd do a podcast. And yeah, we need to get controversy going.
And just say horrible things?
Horrible things. No, I don't know about that. But exciting things or shocking things.
Okay. You're out of control.
No, I'm sorry.
You're acting out.
I know.
Yeah. So, but you're only one, so.
Yeah, I know. It's true.
That's what you get for being 1 year old. Mm-hmm. So I guess that makes a year. I mean, I think we're done.
That's a year. Let's see what happens next year.
So, you know, we're going to put in a plug for people to donate.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to donate to a podcast this week so that we get good karma and someone donates to our podcast.
Well, donate to ours.
Well, maybe, but what? That's kind of incestuous. But I kind of feel like I got to donate to someone else's podcast in order to be, you know.
Well, I've done that. You should do
it. Well, you're good about that. I'm a horrible, selfish person.
But even if it's only $10, it really helps people.
Right.
And you know, we're trying to start a Twitter feed. I would love to get, if there's someone out there listening who's, you know, savvy with these sort of things, you could be our Twitter master.
Twitter master. We'll even say it with a German accent. Twitter Meister.
All right, if someone wants to be our Twitter Meister or help us in any way, want to join us in some capacity, feel free to email us at comments@indieopera.com. Well, happy birthday, Noah. It's been great.
Happy birthday, Peter.
All right.
Talk to you in a bit.
See ya.
Bye.
Got Stitcher? We're on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.